This is Laura Richards of Real Crime Profile. Today's episode was recorded at CrimeCon in Indianapolis this June, where I had the pleasure of introducing Dr. Laura Petler, who gave a presentation about crime scene staging and homicide cases, and she also wrote the book of the same name. After her talk, I managed to grab Laura so that we could sit down and hear more about her work, and Lisa joined the conversation later on when she found us. Dr. Laura is a real Renaissance woman, as she's one of the foremost experts in the world in investigating staged homicides. She's a TV producer and a host, an author, a singer-songwriter, and as we found out through interviewing her, she's a lover of dogs, horses, and medieval weapons. We really hope you enjoy our discussion with Dr. Laura Petler as much as we did talking with her.
My job as a crime scene reconstructionist for the district is to build crime scenes and move them into the courtroom to bring the crime scene to the jury. And we do this by using mannequins. We use different replicas such as styrofoam heads with dowel rods and lasers. Lasers are huge for me. I do a lot with different lasers. So we've got it almost about right here.
Her work has added a new dimension to our efforts to prosecute in our district.
Continue on our stringing.
The value of her work to me is priceless because she is able to bring us an element of the CSI that you see on TV into our courtrooms in our rural counties. Jurors today have come to expect that, and now we are actually able to deliver it to them.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, trained at the FBI, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. And we're here at CrimeCon, as many of you know, and I've had the absolute pleasure of introducing a fantastic professional called Dr. Laura Petler. And I'm going to leave it to Laura to say a little bit about herself, and we're going to give you a little bit of an overview of some of her fascinating work.
Thank you, Laura, for having me today, and thank you for such a warm welcome and introduction during our presentation earlier. I am a forensic criminologist, and I specialize in domestic violence homicides, specifically cold cases, and most often the type of cases that we get are staged cases. I am a former district attorney investigator and a deputy coroner, so I'm so thrilled to be here with you today.
Well, it's fantastic to have you on the show, and I heard so many interesting and fascinating things in your presentation. But for our listeners, just explain what a forensic criminologist is.
A forensic criminologist is, for me, the best of both worlds because forensic criminology blends or marries together the physical evidence with the behavioral evidence. So the physical evidence really shows us what happened, but a lot of the behavioral evidence tells us why it happened. So when you marry those together, we create this mosaic that is the crime. So without behavior, you don't have physical evidence. And without physical evidence, there's typically very little to go on in most people's minds. So we try to bring to light the value of the behavioral evidence so it's just not thrown to the wayside like it's been for so long.
Right. And so, you know, profilers are very much interested in behavior.
Right.
And looking at the what, the where, the how,
right,
the why. And the why is not always easy to understand, but you really want to get to the who.
Yes, we do want to get to the who. And so it's interesting when you start looking at crime scene characteristics and then a criminal profile and how those things can either bolster or start to take away from certain suspects that you might have. So even if you have five suspects, you have certain crime scene characteristics that will match maybe one suspect, but really not match the other ones, which really helps to investigators to narrow the scope of the investigation and get rid of the what we call white noise in victim-centered death investigation methodology, which is what we use to investigate these crimes.
And I'm so glad you said victim-centered, you know, victim-oriented, because as you know, I'm Real Crime Profile.
Yes.
And all the work that I do is about making sure the victim is placed center stage.
Right.
And that we don't memorialize perpetrators, but we understand victims, their experience. And obviously a lot of what you're doing and, you know, profilers do is trying to work out the how as well.
Right.
And you're piecing together bits of information. And I just saw a fantastic demonstration from you on the stage in front
Thank
of about
you.
130 people where you talked about Kaleidoscope, the crime scene reconstruction system. So
yes.
Tell us about that.
Kaleidoscope came to be way back in 2008. It was kind of necessary, so to speak, because back in 2008, I was working at the DA's office and I was lent out to various other DA's offices because we were the only DA's office in the state to have a crime scene reconstruction and behavioral analysis program. And to this day, there has never been another one since I left. And so when the DA's across the state started catching on that this was really helpful to their cases, they would call our office, and my boss, the elected district attorney, would loan me out to other districts to help them reconstruct their scenes. So in this particular case, I was in a place called Caroline, North Carolina, which is really very close to where The Last of the Mohicans movie was filmed, at the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. And it was a case where a drug dealer and a buyer had had an altercation at a post office. The post office had brick walls, and both cars had pulled up into the parking lot beside the brick wall of the post office. And when the drug deal went bad, the drug dealer shot the buyer twice, once in the leg and once in the head. And so the district attorney in that area said to me, the difference between first degree murder and second degree murder is the series of shots, the sequence of events, and how this victim was shot and then ended up on the ground. So my job was to figure out what the position of the victim was using the scientific method. And in this case, there were two shots. So I had to reconstruct one, then reconstruct the other. And what I found was that it was very difficult to do because there was a ricochet involved in this case. When the projectile was fired from the gun and then it went through the head of the victim, it hit the top of the Honda Civic that the victim was standing beside. And it ricocheted off the top of the car, and then it went and it continued on to hit the brick wall. It created monumental obstacles to try to get that trajectory straight. And at that time, I was using wooden dowel rods from what I call the forensic section at Lowe's.
Right. And sometimes you got to make do
that's
with what's
right.
available to
that's
you.
That's exactly right. And I would use those dowel rods and string to reconstruct this. But because we had this ricochet, it was very, very difficult to do that. So I ended up deciding, you know, I really need to try to figure out something where we can shoot dowel rods through something hollow, something at least hollow. And that was my biggest, that was like my furthest thought at that time. I started shooting lasers through straws and other things, and finally decided to start using clear rods, and eventually settled on a rod that we call the tubular dowel. And it actually glows when you light it up with a laser. So now...
Glow in the dark.
Yes, it glows in the dark. It does. It looks just like a glow stick. And so the coolest thing is now you can show where the trajectory is, starting from the shooter, going through the victim, and then to a ricochet mark if necessary, all the way up to the wall of the post office or something. And so that's how tubular dowel was born. Tubular dowel then became the kaleidoscope system when we added the bloodstain side of the house to the system. And so now we have, we actually have a kit called the Mosaic, and it comes with 36 lasers so that you can reconstruct pretty much anything that you'd ever come across. So it's carried by 11 forensics distributors, and it's sold in more than 30 countries around the world.
Which is incredible. And I've got to say, I've just seen it demonstrated, a reconstruction on stage in front of 130 people. And there were a lot of like mini CSI people in the audience.
Yes.
They seemed to know the answers to all your questions.
Yes, they did.
And certainly when you asked, you know, had people seen lasers on the crime show's CSI, lots of people raised their hands. And of course, it was created, invented by yourself.
Yes, I did create that system. And then CBS and other networks bought it from me. And they've used it in their shows. And it's been great. It's been great. We are happy to see it used. And it really kind of accomplishes a couple objectives. It not only makes the crime scene super easy to recon, but then on top of it, you can also use it in the courtroom. So Laura Petler & Associates, the company that I own and the team of experts that I have, that I'm partnered with, we're a round table of experts, and our And our motto of our company is education, training, and consultation from crime scene to courtroom. So we start with the crime scene, typically with the kaleidoscope system, and we end with the kaleidoscope system in the courtroom. So it's a system that can be used in a variety of ways to meet the objectives of what juries typically expect today in America, which is a lot of bling and what they see in the fictional shows on television. So we meet the CSI effect objectives with the system as well.
So see, the CSI effect is a real thing, and you know, we see the impact of that in the UK.
Yes.
But a lot of that show starts with the real professionals who are doing the real work, creating and developing new science and new tactics and tools to understand major crime. So, you know, we want to thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Certainly we want to talk to you in more detail, and we're going to bring you back on the pod. But I want to just mention that we've just been joined by Lisa Zambetti.
Hi. I'm late. Sorry.
This is a live podcast from CrimeCon. So we've been running a number of different sessions, and Lisa's been manning the Real Crime Profile booth. So that's why this is very much a dynamic interview that I just wanted to catch Laura and introduce her to our listeners, and we definitely want to bring her back. So I'm going to ask Lisa whether she has any questions for Laura.
Well, I was just reading your bio, and you know something that she's another one of these super women listeners, just like my Laura, Dr. Laura, just does any, it sounds like anything you set your mind to, you did not take the word no. That is not in your vocabulary.
It is not in my vocabulary.
So, you know, you have so many, your inventions, your entrepreneurship, your, you know, so many things about you. But what I really loved is how much you honor your family and your father in your description. Yeah. So she has a tattoo on her arm. She just showed me.
I do.
And, you know, a lot of people don't share that side of themselves. You know, they don't put that forward. Maybe they think it's a weakness to show your feelings or things about your personal life, you know, but you just like put it right out there on who your dad was, what he meant to you.
Yes.
And that just really stuck with me as I was reading about you.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, my father was an incredible person. He's been gone a year ago since April 20th. It's okay. He fell ill and died within about 12 days when I was out on the book tour. Yes. And it was very unexpected and very shocking. My dad was a person who started from a very young age working very hard. His dad died when he was 7 years old, and they owned a brickyard, and they made something called Petler Brick in Pittsburgh. And a lot of the brick that you see around the Pittsburgh area, the roads and things that are built, are actually built from Petler Brick. It's very interesting. And my dad came from a Jewish family who was very traditional. And so my dad started as a young child trying to help support the family after his dad died by raking leaves, shoveling snow. And then as he got physically bigger, when he was 12, he went to go work in the brickyard. And he would mine clay out of the side of the mountain that was owned by Petler Brick and shoot it down a chute. He did this with his bare hands and would pull clay out of the mountain and shoot it down into the brickyard so they could make bricks. And he learned that hard work was the way out of no matter what you were faced with. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting because my dad was married way before I came along to a woman, and he and that woman adopted me from an orphanage. I was actually an orphan. And I started out, that was like a key point in my life, that, you know, being an orphan. And then they didn't stay married. They were divorced. And so it ended up to be just me and my dad. And he went through a really hard time after that. And it was a hard time for both of us because he was grieving the loss of his marriage and things of that nature. And then I had my daughter at 17 years old. And he was... I have never seen an angrier man. I have never seen a person who was beyond himself as far as, oh my gosh, you've ruined your life.
Oh.
And I said, no, I haven't ruined my life. This is just one of those challenges that happen. I made a really bad decision. I'm going to pay for that. But I promise you, Dad, do not worry. I'm going to be just fine. And he didn't believe me until after my daughter was born, and 8 months later, we were fine. I was getting ready to go to college, and he was just like, okay, you're going to be all right. So, my journey has not been easy, but it has been very fulfilling because my focus has always been on victims and standing for what I believe is right. And I definitely do not back down to what I believe is right. And I try to use my life to make a difference. And for 41 years, every time my dad would get off the phone with me or we'd have a conversation or I'd be like, okay, I'm leaving, I'm going out or whatever, he'd be like, all right, get out there and sock it to him. And I lived by those words. And I didn't really feel it when I was younger, Lisa, but then once I was older, I really understood what sock it to him meant. And everything I did as an adult, I did because my dad built me. As a child, he used to give me pieces of garbage, paper, wood, and metal, and say, here, here's a pile of trash, build something, make it into something. And I would have to invent things that couldn't exist, that never existed. So I really love animals, and so I would build things that could catch salamanders in creeks, and I would use all kinds of weird little things, and then he'd say, all right, let's go out and test it. And we would go out down to the creeks and in the woods, and I would test my animal traps and my animal catchers and things like that. So he built me to be strong and resilient and to use my life to help other people, and that's what I do.
Well, he sounds incredible.
And, thank you.
And, I mean, not only to be a single father, he was probably one of the few single fathers.
Yeah, sure.
And then just to keep supporting you and inspiring you and not trying to make you into a little perfect little girl or whatever.
I mean, it's amazing. Inspiring. It's inspiring. And also it's in your human design that you were creating things out of nothing and deconstructing things. And, of course, that's what you do now.
Yes.
Which is incredible.
He totally built me to do exactly what I'm doing. He never thought I would use it to do what I'm doing. He thought I would be a banker like him. But I wasn't. This was my passion to get into helping other people. So in Cold Case, there's plenty of people to help. You know, you both know we have more than 200,000 cold cases in the U.S. And there's not enough of us out there working to solve them. So I'm definitely trying to take my share. When we see power assertive type crime scenes like this, that, you know, where there's just a tremendous amount of power and force used to subdue a victim very quickly, we see a macho kind of guy, an over macho type of reaction a lot of times, where he's not going to allow anyone to threaten who is in control, which is him.
Okay.
So there's going to be no threat of control there. He's going to dominate. He's going to take control. He's going to, you know, make sure that this goes.
Just so our listeners know, Laura is also the vice president of the American Investigative Society of Cold Cases.
I am, and have been for 3 years. I've served as vice president. Before then, I served as director of development and also on the honorary review board with Jim Clemente, in fact. So I've known Jim for about 4 years through the association and worked with him there. The American Investigative Society of Cold Cases is a group of volunteers who review cold cases for law enforcement for free. And we try to give them new ideas and agencies new leads to try to move those cases forward. Not every case is solvable, but we work very hard to make the ones that are solvable a little bit easier for the agency to get over some of the obstacles that are keeping it cold. So that's kind of the purpose.
Such important work. And just to say to the listeners, my voice is rasping because I've been talking too much in air-conditioned rooms, so I'm sorry about the state of my voice. But certainly I was asked to join the society as well. And as you mentioned, Jim's a member, and I know many others, and you do great work there.
Thank you.
So thank you for doing that.
Oh, absolutely, our pleasure. We love what we do, and we love trying to make a difference in other people's lives, for sure.
Jim and I feel strongly about, too, and some of the cases we've been reinvestigating and the cases we talk about on Real Crime Profile.
Right. I listen to your podcast all the time.
You do?
I do.
In the car, Laura was telling me.
I do.
Going to different events and listening to RCP.
I typically drive to my set for Notorious for my new web series, which is located in the Pittsburgh area.
Okay.
And so I drive from North Carolina and listen to you guys to and from.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I love your podcast. I listen to lots of the different episodes and the series of cases that you'll do. And I get a lot of ideas from you, Laura, and from Jim and from Lisa. I get a lot of ideas, and I actually write them down on my phone as I'm driving, because sometimes what you guys are talking about, just as fellow colleagues, I'm like, that's something important for one of my cases that I'm working on. So then I have a list of all these different things that I write down on my phone. I mean, literally, I could show it to you. It's very long. Of things that you guys talk about that make me think, you know what, I think I need to look at that in this case that I'm looking at as well. So it's really, for me, it's a collaboration. Even though I'm not talking, I'm listening, which is always smarter than talking, you know, is to listen. I listen to you guys, and it makes me think of things that, you know, I could maybe do in my own work, because the beauty of diversity is something that we should embrace when it comes to cold case, and, you know, get rid of this egocentric type of work where, oh no, it's my crime scene, or no, this is my cold case. No, this is about the victim. This isn't about you. So I really appreciate you guys, because it gives me something to really put my brain on while I'm driving.
That's incredible.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
Yes,
Lisa and I are beaming at the moment.
I know.
You're welcome.
We try and reach professionals as well. And obviously, this is about collaborative work.
You're
and we want to
them.
Get out best practice and work with the people in the business as well. So thank you for sharing. And
absolutely.
Please tell us about your new docu-web series, Notorious, that streams on June the 21st.
Yes, we are so excited about Notorious, and a couple reasons why. First of all, the serial killer that is the focus of our season one is a guy named Edward Arthur Surratt. He operated in the 70s, and he wasn't well covered by the media, so a lot of people aren't even aware that he's on the radar.
Which area is this? Beaver.
In Beaver County. And that's where I grew up, in Beaver County, north of Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania. So we center there, and we're with the Beaver County Times, which is the local newspaper there. And my co-executive producer is Gwen Titley, and she is the videographer from the newspaper there. And literally, we're a two-woman crew that set out to do this. And we have interviewed countless people, Gwen has done most of the research in the case, and we've basically created 13 episodes that are 7 to 10 minutes long in web series format that will begin streaming on notoriouswebseries.com on June 21st. And we just take it from a victim-centered perspective and explain what was happening in the community, what it felt like to be terrified by this guy who was known as the Shotgun Slayer during this period of time. So I've been finishing up all the music and things like that I've been writing for the series, because when you're on no budget, you have to do everything yourself.
Yeah, that's the other thing. She's right? Also a musician, by the way.
I am a musician. But it was great because, you know, I didn't have to pay anybody for the music, right?
There you go.
And my daughter sings as well, and she sung the song that we wrote for the theme song. So we hope that everyone's going to like Notorious. And this fall, I will be on Dr. Oz, and part of his season 9 is part of his True Crime Tuesdays, which are extending into a second day this season. And I'm very excited to hopefully focus on some domestic violence cases and offer my expertise to the audience that way. So those are the two big projects I have going on right
That's
now.
That's amazing.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And, you know, Laura is a mother and daughter team. Her daughter was here helping with the reconstruction. So this is kind of like the mother and daughter badass team, and truly inspiring to see you both working together.
It's great because, you know, she's 25 now and I'm 42, and we made it. We didn't die. We didn't starve to death.
Yeah.
We did not freeze to death, all of which I thought would happen, you know, because I was so young. I didn't know how I was going to do this, but I just knew I had to do it. And so now she's 25. She works for me full time, along with Angie King, who is our operations manager at LPA. And I can't survive without either one of them. I mean, they run the show. They're the glue of the company. So yeah, my daughter has been working with me in crime scenes since she was about 12 years old.
Which is impressive, and an all-female team. And I say that sat here with Lisa and Laura as well. three of us, and of course Paul, our engineer, who's making this happen today.
You're an honorary woman, honey.
He's an honorary woman.
Yeah, thank Paul, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're a beautiful woman, Paul.
So let's just, you know, finish off, see if there are any other questions, but just tell us quickly about your book and where people can get your book from.
So after my dissertation, which was called Crime Scene Behaviors of Crime Scene Stagers, it's the third dissertation in the world on crime scene staging. And Laura, as you know, we have a tremendous gap in the literature on crime scene staging.
Absolutely.
And especially when it comes to domestic violence crime scene staging, it's virtually non-existent. Similar to what you found when you were developing DASH.
That's right. With risk assessment, there was no literature on it. I mean, one or two papers, and now there's been a proliferation. So Laura and I share this, and when she presented me with her book after I introduced her today, I was so excited to be able to read it. And it literally just fell open on the chapter on domestic violence and staged homicides. I've certainly been an advisor on a number of those. And I'd love to bring you back to talk about that subject in particular in a lot more detail.
I would appreciate that, because our Crime Scene Staging Awareness Initiative is to build awareness of the connection of intimate partner violence to crime scene staging, because that's where we see it most often. And it's really important because, of course, as you know, we have stalking involved in domestic violence, and that can lead to becoming a homicide victim. So it's very important. But the book really is a first log on the fire. It's something that I hope will get people interested in the topic, because it's the first book in the world on the topic. How can that be? How can we be in 2015 when it was published? And this is our first book in the world on crime scene staging. So I think that, you know, the book has a lot of good points in it that our research will carry on. And then there's are going to be other things about the book that are included in there that are not going to carry on, as the research shows, you know, those things aren't as important. The three main things people need to remember is that conflict precedes all murders. And what we have is a matrix that we use called, it's a victim-centered matrix called conflict resolution benefit. And what that means is that you can identify any of the preceding conflict between the victim and the offender. So especially, as you know, Laura, the crime scene can reflect the conflict, such as if it's about power and control, which all domestic violence homicides are always about power and control.
Absolutely, and coercive control.
Yes, you can see that reflected in your crime scene, because that crime scene is a reflection of the personality. Mahoning County investigators begin to suspect Linda of having killed her husband, given that homicide statistics tell us that most murder victims are killed by someone they know. At autopsy, the medical examiner found that David Hamilton died from injuries he sustained from two gunshot wounds to the head, fired from a .38 caliber firearm. The offender. So people typically die the way they live and live the way they kill. So we see this cycle of violence not only portrayed during the live relationship between the two, the victim and the offender, but then that same cycle of violence and that same pattern of pervasive abuse is exemplified and illustrated for us in the crime scene. What changes is when that offender tweaks that, manipulates it, tampers with it to make it appear that the victim died of another way. And then That's how the offender resolves the conflict, is through murder. Murder is conflict resolution for the offender. And then you might have five suspects, but only one is going to truly benefit from the death of that victim. So everything that you identify in conflict, such as maybe there's debt, maybe there's a money problem, maybe there's an affair, you can move all those conflicts over to the resolution, over to then the benefit, and say, does the death of the victim resolve the conflict of debt? Yes, because now this guy or this woman can cash in a policy or something like that. So we have lots of little ways that we're trying to teach investigators of how to investigate domestic violence when it comes to staging, to prevent stagers from getting away with murder and then leaving them in society with an opportunity to kill again. And like we see in cases like Drew Peterson, they do.
Absolutely right. And certainly, you know, with staging, offenders take the time and the effort, because it's worth the risk. They want to be able to put people's attention outside and away from them and what's been going on. They want to deflect,
right?
Because obviously they want to try and hide and manipulate of who has really committed this crime. And I've always said, a picture paints 1,000 words, but going to the scene tells you 1,000,000. And what you're doing is recreating that scene so that we can profile it and understand who was where, who may have done what, where, how, when. And of course, it's very revealing about the actual perpetrator or perpetrators.
Right. And it also helps you rule out the ones that don't fit, because the behavioral evidence and criminally profiling all of the who and the what and the why, like you're saying, really illustrates, you know, what type of an offender is going to commit this type of a crime. And when they stage the scene, they're basically just giving you a snapshot of what's in their mind. This is what they think a suicide looks like. The average Joe has not seen a bunch of suicides like people like us have seen, Laura, in the field.
That's right.
And so this image that you see in the crime scene is what they think it looks like. They don't know that's what a suicide looks like, or
what they've read
robbery,
or what they've seen on the
exactly.
TV.
Exactly. So they take what they've learned, or they take what they think, and so what you're seeing is actually a reflection of their mind. And so it's very, very interesting.
It can be very revealing. And yes. We have to remember a particular victim, victims are chosen, particular victim at a particular time, in right. a particular place, for a particular reason, by a particular perpetrator, and we're trying to shed light on those things, and a crime scene is incredibly revealing. So,
and it's a victim-offender relationship. There's no reason to stage if that offender is not going to be directly connected to that victim. That's why we don't see it in some other types of crimes, like drive-by shootings or other things like that. Sometimes some types of even organized crime, we don't see staging there.
As if there's no relationship,
there's no relationship.
To conceal or hide it?
That's exactly right.
So we're going to get into this in more detail. We just wanted to give our listeners an understanding of, for Lisa and I, some of the incredible people we've met at CrimeCon, and Laura's one of them.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you so much
for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I know
that we'll be talking again.
Yes.
Really soon. Right.
Thank you very much. We'll be coming back to you very soon with another installment of Dr. Laura Pettler's fascinating work. So please check it out. She's also on Twitter.
At Dr. Laura Pettler.
Yeah. And we didn't even get into Frisian horses and arrows. But we're going to do that next time.
Oh, that's right. That's the other thing I read. I thought I dreamed that.
I like medieval archery. I love everything medieval. And so I have Frisian horses, and I've learned to be a mounted archer with primitive recurve bows.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just something different.
Yeah.
You know, it's different, and I've had horses my whole life, and so it's just something I really enjoy. And my dogs, Jimmy John and
Jimmy John, who I talked about on your introduction, he's so cute.
Laura killed me because she she said something about Jimmy John. I was like, oh my God, how do you even know about Jimmy John?
The proud owner of Jimmy John. He melted my heart. I had to bring him into the room. So this is Real Crime Profile signing off. If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the Domestic Violence Hotline on 800-799-7233.